This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. This is the last episode of Season 2 of Connect the Dots. Season 3 is going to be coming up next month. Now, we have completed a whole year of Connect the Dots here at Center for Progressive Reform. It was an experiment, and we started with the idea that we could bring smart talk with experts on issues related to health, safety, and the environment to a podcast audience, and that many of you would want to listen. And I have to say, it's been way more successful than we originally expected, and we are really encouraged to keep going forward. Over this process, you've gotten to know us, and we have gotten to know you a little bit too. We know, for instance, that most of our listeners are between 25 and 45 years of age, and we are skewing toward the younger end of that range, which is wonderful because there is such excitement and energy in politics and in government among those in that demographic, and we are thrilled to be part of the conversations that you're listening to. Obviously, most of our listeners are coming from the United States, but we have real pockets of listeners in the United Kingdom, in Spain, in Croatia, Sweden, Australia. And thank you so much if you're listening from any of those places or anywhere else overseas, because we're really glad to have you. I have been hearing from more and more of you individually, either through tweets or by email. And one of the things that's so important is that I and others at CPR have gotten to hear what you like about the show and what you'd like to see improved in upcoming episodes. So one of the things we get the most praise for are the topics, things like the climate litigation, food safety. These are episodes that really sparked a lot of attention, and a lot of you want to hear more about what agencies are doing, what the federal government is doing, and how it affects your lives. Also hear from a number of teachers and instructors in universities who use some of these episodes in the classroom as supplemental material to some of the course reading. And of course, I love that because I'm a professor too, and I've done the same thing. And another thing that listeners like is the in-depth attention that we pay to these issues. We try to make it engaging. We certainly want to make it accessible. But we are going down deep and trying to connect the dots so that you can see how the inner workings of government are affecting your life and the lives of community members around you. And that's something that you're telling us that you want absolutely more of and that you appreciate. Now, are there things that we can improve? Yes, of course there are things we can improve. And I especially am interested in hearing about that from all of you listeners. One of the things that I am hearing is that listeners would like this show to be a little less formal. I have to admit, in the first two seasons, we've been a little, I guess you'd say, NPR-ish. You have given us permission to be a little more chatty while at the same time being substantive. And some of you also like the idea of having more than one guest on at a time, which I think is a good idea too. And we have already been upgrading our technology so that we'll be able to do that better. I mean, I have to say, we started this out on a technological shoestring using Apple's GarageBand and a small but mighty USB mic. But we've been working on that, and season three is definitely, we are upgrading our production software, our mics, and our feed streams. And so I think you'll be pleased with the production values that we have coming up in season three. Many listeners also said that they're interested in more ways to interact with the show, and in particular, communicate with me about topics that they would find interesting, guests that they would find interesting, and so on. And in particular, you have asked that I spend more time with the guests on particularly trying to find out what it is that listeners and their governments can do to address these problems, many of which are, of course, very broad and sometimes seem almost intractable. But one of the points of this show is that once you see how things are connected, you can see what you can do and what others can do in your community and your government to make things better. And so I'm going to be spending some time thinking about how to emphasize that in our upcoming shows. In the meantime, the best way for you to interact with us, there are three things that you can do. One is we have our website for the Center for Progressive Reform. It's www.progressivereform.org. And there you can find lots of information about many of the topics that we've discussed. We actually have show pages on each episode with lots more material and many documents that are referred to or publications that are referred to in our interviews. That's one way for you to learn more about us. Now, to communicate with me and to the rest of the CPR folk, the best thing I would say that you can do is to tweet me. You can follow me at Rob Virchik, and I always respond, and I certainly always read everything that that people say having to do with Connect the Dots. The other thing that you can do is email me at rob@progressivereform.org. And I will make sure to respond to you personally. And if you have other ideas about how we can make it easier for you to communicate or to interact with us, let me know. We're going to be working on that too. We have an Instagram account and some other things coming up. Now, let's turn to the subject of our last episode of season two. We're closing out the season with an interview recorded live with former Senator Mary Landrieu at Loyola University New Orleans College of Law. So that means she overlapped with Bill Clinton, George W., and Barack Obama. Landrieu is a political moderate, and she was certainly one of the more conservative Democrats to serve in the Senate. She voted, for instance, in 2002 for the Iraq resolution. She supported the Keystone Pipeline initiative in the Obama administration, and she defended the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage on the grounds that a majority of Louisianans had voted for that, even though she personally said that she supported same-sex marriage. So progressives were not always on her side, and environmentalists were often skeptical of Senator Landrieu, too, because of her support of the oil and gas industry in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast. But she absolutely earned her stripes on certain environmental issues. She was a major national influence in bringing attention to the need for recovery of New Orleans and southern Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, for instance, in securing money to help the state of Louisiana and neighboring states recover after the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. So she's an interesting political figure for sure. She's smart, very committed to the welfare of citizens in Louisiana, and also very concerned with the climate crisis. And so we talked about that in this interview, and also about her views about the Green New Deal and about the prospects of putting a price on carbon. But the first question I asked her had to do with climate change, coastal restoration, and the state of Louisiana. Now, keep in mind, we were in a beautiful hall on the Loyola campus, but it was large, and so you might hear a bit of an echo in this recording. Many folks in the audience might have seen this recent copy, this new issue of The New Yorker. There's a really interesting article by Elizabeth Colbert, the environmental writer, in there, writing about Louisiana and the Vanishing Coast. And she makes the point, as you just did, that New Orleans is really a proving ground for building resilience to climate impacts, things like stronger storms and harder rains and higher sea level rise, and that we need to work on that here in New Orleans to be more resilient and in southern Louisiana as well. How well are we doing at that?
Well, I would say that we have come a long way since May 3rd, 1978, for sure, as a city, as a region. Some of those lessons have been very hard-learned lessons because of one flood after another, after another, after another, then the storms and the hurricanes. We've, I think, gotten people in New Orleans and this general area pretty are clear, I think, about the causes of this. It's not just the rising sea level and climate caused by the burning of fossil fuels and too much car and other things, not just fossil fuels, other things, steel, concrete, transportation, etc. But too much carbon, as I've commended to you all, Rising Tide, it is the sort of the seminal work on the seven, correct? The Great Flood of 1927 that shook the foundations of the politics. I mean, the levees to protect people all along the river in the middle part of the United States. Remember, Thomas Jefferson leveraged the entire federal treasury to purchase this land, which was how important it is. New Orleans, the mouth of the river and the river. He knew how valuable that was for our country to develop. Well, in 1927, fast forward, the flood comes. The levees are started to be built over the next, 50 to 75 years. And so the river stops overflowing as a river naturally does. Like if you let a hose out and the hose can wiggle and it'll move back and forth and the water will move as the hose moves. Well, if you tie it down, it will gouge a channel and then the sediment falls on the sides. That happened. And then in around 1940, so some years after the 27, the first offshore well was drilled off the coast of Jennings in 12 feet of water. And there was this huge influx in the 40s and 50s and 60s prior to the EPA, prior to NEPA, prior to any federal regulations, prior to really the scientists even understanding what does it mean to drill a channel in a marsh. And people didn't call them wetlands, they called them wastelands. I mean, the only people that knew how valuable they were, I think back then, were the trappers, the fishermen, and maybe the farmers. Oystermen, of course, knew it, and the fishermen, but the rest of us living in cities just saw those wetlands as some didn't do it correctly. And so the combination of the river, the channels that let salt water into the marsh, and then the fossil fuel happening today, not in the future. We know this is happening. Rickel was sort of pointing out, I'm not sure that she focused as much on the channelization of the river as I would.
We have been quite involved in coastal, as much as anyone, more than anyone, in the city of New York, which is planning its U-wall to protect. I just see a lot of hungry mouths that are open.
You see, that's where those. One short answer of that, which is the saddest answer, but 50. How many do we have? Seven. How many do you think Texas has? 40. We have seven. But hopefully I can end on a happier note story here in this room today. Believe me, in 1978, there weren't seminars like this. I mean, people really weren't. Now, Shirley's here. Shirley Laska, you've been doing this a long time. Okay, Shirley, so you correct me. You hold your city. Oh, my gosh, it's the marsh. It's gone. You know, I mean, it took us a while to kind of discover it and kind of learn about it and et cetera. But when I got to the Senate, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, it's the marsh and it's gone and we're sinking and this is before climate, blah, blah. I was treasurer. I was state treasurer. I'm very curious. It drives my friends crazy because I'm always asking a lot of questions and it drives them crazy. But it's a good thing to be curious because I kept saying, like Rob says, where are we going to get the money to fix this? I mean, even if we can find out the problem and figure out how much it's going to cost us, restoration of the marsh, new strategies for building, new zoning laws so that people aren't, living where, in the lowest lying areas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where will we get the money? Well, I found a source. I learned, because when I was state treasurer, you all might remember this, there was a settlement called, for law students, you should know this, it's called the 8G settlement. It was a dispute that went on for over 20 years between the federal government and the states about where the line of Louisiana stops and where the line of the federal government starts, offshore. So all states come into the union with different boundaries. Texas came in with 10 miles. Louisiana came in with 3 miles offshore. But what was happening is the federal government was drilling, let's say, at 3.1 miles. But they were sapping the oil from the 2.8 marker. So we would say to them, you're in your lane drilling, but you're taking the reservoir is under our land. So there was a dispute, and that's called in the law 8G. It got settled, and the federal government said, yes, Louisiana, you're right, and here's a check for $650 million. Well, that check came to me. Not really the whole check, but, you know, I've never really seen a $650 million check. It would be a great check to see, but it was deposited into the account. So I'm thinking, this is interesting. That's a lot of money. Edwin Edwards took $100 million for his politics and gave the rest to me to deposit. That is a true story. Not he took it personally, but he took it, put it in the budget to spend. But $650 million of it went to a trust fund, which we still have. And that fund is called the AG Fund, and it's now valued at billions of dollars. It funds the professorships at the university. So I managed that money, and thank God I did a good job. And so that money's still there, and it's protected. And I didn't do it all myself, but the legislature and the Betsy Board, we all protected it. But it gave me an idea. So I said, well, where did this money come from? Like, did the federal government just give it out of the general fund? Well, then I went to Washington, and I found out that every year on federal land, the federal government was making billions of dollars off of federal land in states like Wyoming and Colorado and New Mexico, because there's a lot of federal land, which I did not realize. Louisiana has only 2.5% of federal land. Colorado has 40% of their land is owned by the federal government. In Alaska, 90% of their land is owned by the federal government. Y'all may know this. I did not know it. Get to Washington, figure this out, and realize that when the federal government drills on federal land, they get a severance and a royalty. And so the federal government is getting billions and billions of dollars. So then I thought, well then where... how much money are they getting off of our coast? Well, when I looked, it's roughly, you can go back over history, it's roughly an average of $10 billion a year that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. Not Colorado. Colorado has billions. New Mexico, Wyoming's billions. New Mexico's a few hundred million. These numbers are all public numbers. But roughly, it's onshore, interior, offshore. And when you talk about offshore U.S., there are a few wells off of California, but they're operating, but they don't do prospective drilling. It's just current producing wells. No drilling off the eastern shore. People have proposed it, not happening yet. Florida's under a moratorium. So the only drilling that goes on is off Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, which 80% is our land. For maritime lawyers in here, you'll see how the lines are drawn out 200 miles. So when you ask me where we're going to get the money, my idea, it's not my idea, our idea, many of us have had this idea, is to get a portion of the offshore oil and gas revenues. If we had been getting that since the 1920s or 1930s when it started, not going to happen. Nobody would allow it. Well, you know what? Wyoming has Louisiana has 4.5 million people roughly. We drill off of our coast, just miles off of our coast. You can see the rigs if you go down to Grand Isle and St. Rose. You can see them. St. Mary Parish, you can see it. We send approximately $10 billion every year to the federal government and get virtually nothing, despite the fact that a Pasco Mesa, which gives us about $375 million to split four ways. Pennies. So it got me pretty aggravated. I filed a bill, long story, it passed the House by 318 votes. Got to the Senate. As a freshman senator, I had 72 signatures on a letter, which if any of you know how the Senate works, all you need is 60. I had 72. And it was not pulled up for a vote, and we lost it like this much. This was 20 years ago. It was a bill that would give, at that time, only $400 million to coastal states to split, some money for land and water conservation, and some money for wildlife. The point being that several people have tried over time to say, wait a minute, this is a big problem. We need resources to it. We've got to get some of this money. And one place to get money is from offshore oil and gas revenues and allow the coastal states, whether you drill or not, was always my position, whether you like to drill for oil and gas or not, but use some of that money to protect your coast. So that fight is still going on, I'm proud to say. Gomesa passed, and then it laid the groundwork when the accident happened with the Deepwater Horizon. We had gotten people in Washington so keen and so worked up or so educated or so leaning forward, maybe is a better way to say it, that when that happened, Sheldon Whitehouse, Barbara Boxer, and a bunch of people said, you know, Mary, you're right. I mean, this money really should stay in the Gulf, and we'll work with you to keep it in the Gulf. And so we were able to secure some of the penalty money from Restore. But that was a one-time, it was a horrible accident, and it's like using penalties if your car is stolen or in a drug robbery. But it's not an ongoing, recurring, in a happy day. That's a sad day. That's an event, money you got from a sad day. We need money from a happy, regular day, a recurring, reliable source of money. So my answer is, you're either going to raise taxes for it. We need about $1 billion a year. We are owed more than $1 billion a year from the federal government. You either got to raise $1 billion in taxes. You either have to sue the companies and make them pay $1 billion or $2 billion, which is some people's strategy. Or you have to go get it out of the general fund of the Treasury. But my thinking is just give us parity with the interior states and let us use that offshore oil and gas revenue money to do resiliency. And so that's hopefully what we're thinking about. And there's bills in now to continue to raise the Gomesa cap to work on that. And I'm hoping that maybe a combination of things that included might be where we can fund at billions of dollars a year the funding we need for New York, New Jersey, New Orleans, you know, Miami, Houston, et cetera. I'm open to other ideas, but nickels and dimes aren't going to do it. I mean, we need a reliable, steady stream of revenue, a couple of $1 billion a year going into this around the country.
One criticism I hear when I travel and talk about this is that on one hand, Louisiana, I think, understands climate impacts in a way that few other states do, and we are going gangbusters in trying to prepare for climate impacts. But we don't do a very good job at the other side of the equation, which is reducing carbon emissions, which in fact cause the problems. And local journalism, Bob Marshall, has said that Louisiana is like a lung cancer patient that is demanding the best health care, but at the same time refuses to stop smoking. You said you were open to other ideas, and another idea that come from a friend of yours, Sheldon Whitehouse, when he was down here on a fact-finding mission, and some students and I had the privilege of talking to him about this. He suggested another way of funding coastal restoration in Louisiana would be to put a fee on carbon emissions, and that fee could then go into the federal treasury and then be distributed, a portion of it, he would say half, to all the states to use as they would want, whether that's to pension out coal miners in West Virginia or, in our case, perhaps building the coast. And that would have the result of lowering fossil fuel use and sort of decoupling the use of fossil fuel with the funding of our coast. What do you think?
Sorry. I'm actually open to that idea and would say that that's the only other large source of revenue that is identifiable as a carbon fee or a carbon tax. It would generate at $40 a ton or up trillions and trillions of dollars. There is tremendous political headwind against that idea, but it's growing in acceptance. There was a referendum just defeated in Washington State on this exact subject. You could go back and look at it. So if it can't pass Washington State, you'd have to think, how could it pass Louisiana? Because they're a very pro-environmental state. Jay Inslee, the governor there, led this effort. So you can do the political calculations yourself. But Sheldon, as Senator Whitehouse, is correct about this, and that there are only two real good sources of revenue that you could get your head around, that you could think it's in the realm of political possibility that could generate enough money to do, Rob, what we're talking about doing. Because 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and when we passed GOMESA, having the four Gulf Coast states receiving those fundings right after Katrina, when GOMESA passed, that's how it got passed. I talked about it for over a decade. And the Senate and House finally said, you know what, Senator Landrieu and her delegation, the delegation's correct. And I have to say, our whole delegation supported, every governor, Republican and Democrat. For us, this isn't a political issue. We were all united. And they said, yes, the Louisiana delegation. And before I got there, Russell Long had talked about it. And Bennett Johnson had talked about it. And Billy Tozan had talked about it. And John Breaux had talked about it. They've been hearing this from our delegation for decades. So when Katrina hit, they finally said, they're right. And they passed GOMESA. Thank goodness that gives us the first dedicated $375 million a year, come hell or high water, there'll be both, to spend on our coast. And it's divided between Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Texas. So, but now you fast forward 15 years. This is post-Sandy, post-Ike. You know, Miami is under pressure. And so when we come with another bill, they're not going to just say, okay, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and Louisiana, y'all can go ahead and have extra, leave us high and dry. So I think, A, the politics, now everybody's awake, which is good, but hungry mouths to feed. We're going to have to figure that out. So it's either sharing the offshore oil and gas revenues or doing a carbon fee or tax that would generate enough money. But if one takes 20 years, we need to do the one that's the soonest, you know what I'm saying, and not make the perfect the enemy of the good. We can always add to it. So I say let's do the revenue sharing piece, which might have a little bit more bipartisan right now support. And then if we ever do get a carbon tax or a carbon fee, we could add to it. But let me say this. As a leader that has led a state that has offshore, that has oil and gas for years, I would, in defense of Louisiana, say natural gas is helping to solve part of our problem as it displaces coal and oil. It's cleaner than both. Number two, but it still causes problems itself, but it's cleaner than both. If you work on the methane issues in natural gas and can contain and control the methane, which is a big fight going on right now between President Trump that wants to roll back the Obama-level methane rules, and the industry supporting the rules, the majority of the industry. So here you have President Trump rolling back a regulation that most of the industry, at least the majors say, and Fred Krupp from the Environmental Defense Fund, hey, we can do this and we should. So if you get the methane rules in place, you put your natural gas, use your natural gas. I'm a big believer in nuclear power, you know, which is zero carbon emissions, have nuclear, strong renewable portfolio rules and regulations. So while I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm one of these that would say you can end fossil fuels in 10 years, I most certainly think if you move to gas, which the market is moving to gas and displacing oil and coal now, and put in a carbon fee, you could create a market that would drive us to a zero emissions over time, which would probably be something that people in Louisiana could support. Our delegation has not been leading on this, but I think people in Louisiana are really waking up and realizing that we need to do something. So, you know, I'm not saying a carbon tax would pass in Louisiana today, but I do think that people are thinking if we could just get this marketplace right, there's money to be made on both sides of this, and it could really work out well for industry. And the other, let me just say one more thing. Our chemical industry, Rob, doesn't get the credit for being as efficient as they have been over time. And one of the reasons that they don't like regulation is if the government comes in and says, okay, you have to get 50% more efficient, but we're not going to give you credit for the 100% more efficiency you went in the last decade. We're just starting from here. So giving a goal to how, you know, you want X amount of, you'll accept X amount of emissions and give the industry the opportunity to reach that goal without being prescriptive in your regulations is a way that I think politically you could get the industry here delegations like ours, Texas, Oklahoma, to lean a little forward, and maybe there could be some political compromise.
Well, all right, let's take a short break. Listeners, if you like what you're hearing today, you will love our blog post, CPR Blog. That's where you can read brief, engaging opinions from our legal scholars and staff, written to connect to people just like you on all the issues that you care about. Food safety, restoration of the nation's waters like the Chesapeake Bay, and all those lawsuits filed by cities against oil and gas companies over climate change. We're at www.progressivereform.org. Check us out. You'll be glad you did. And I want to talk about the Green New Deal, which is, as many know, is kind of a roadmap that was proposed out of the House. That's hugely comprehensive, and it involves addressing climate change, social inequality, by means of reforms to energy use and transportation and labor relations and job training and lots and lots of things. And I get in discussions all the time with people who are interested in policy around climate change, and it sort of is getting distilled between something incremental and bipartisan, as you point out, and something which you might say is slow and steady, versus something that's big and bold, or, you know, go big or go home. And I guess I'm wondering, from a political point of view, from the point of view of the politics on the left, the progressives, is this a good move to be talking about big and bold Green New Deal, or would we be better off on the progressive side talking about slow and steady incrementalism?
See, I'm not sure those are our two choices, and I would just respectfully say that I think you can be big and bold and be innovative and use technology and be smart and be exciting and not just think that big, bold, and heavy regulation is always the way, as opposed to big, bold market initiatives. And I'll give you an example. I just visited with one of the top scientists at Arizona State University on climate, on carbon sequestration, and taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Because not only do we have to stop producing carbon or produce less of it, and it's not just oil and gas, cars, emissions, etc. Cement produces a tremendous amount of carbon. So if you want to stop producing carbon, are you going to just say, okay, no more cement, America, that's it, done, no more. No more. Done. How about steel? You know, the production of steel produces a tremendous amount of carbon. So when these on the left say it's not just ending fossil fuel, if you're ending carbon, you're shutting down an economy that's running in every single way that we run on carbon. So if you could create a market that would price carbon to, you know, let less use of it, it would move people to creating systems like this scientist was saying. He said, we believe the science is there. Now, some people will disagree with this, but the scientists are pretty clear that they believe they can not only stop carbon from coming, which is a lot of efficiency, but they can get carbon out of the atmosphere, basically like a big fan that captures it, like you put a sticky glue capturing flies out of, I mean, I'm exaggerating, you know, I'm just saying this, you know, you put like a fly machine, you capture flies to, it captures carbon like that. Now, making it commercial and industrial and making it cost effective is one thing, but only 15 years ago, we were saying the same thing about wind and solar. It's too expensive. You're never going to be able to do it. They've tried it, but it's, you know, it's never. Now the price of producing a kilowatt by solar is pretty inexpensive, as well as wind, so it's the same thing. So I'm finding a change, an exciting change in the oil and gas industry, in the petrochemical industry, in the C-suites of men and women that run these big industries. They're excited about, or maybe excited is too strong of a word. They are very intrigued by the opportunity for new markets and new technology. And that's why you hear more and more about carbon sequestration and storage. Louisiana, South Louisiana, is a great place for carbon to be used for oil and gas drilling, put it back into the ground. So you could have fossil fuel extraction and put the carbon back into the ground, just like through efficiencies you take pollutants out of the atmosphere. Now that creates an opportunity for a big and bold and combination of goals and objectives where you have more hydro, more solar, more wind, carbon capture, sequestration, and you can see then how the U.S. could start leading the world again in that. And the reason that carbon capture is so important is because it's not just the U.S. we're talking about. If you think about China and the coal reserves that they have, they're not just going to shut those coal plants down. The new ones that are coming on in China are much more efficient than the old ones. But if we can come up with technology that all the carbon that comes out is burned or is in the atmosphere we can collect, that is exciting. And that's where I'm kind of hoping the Climate Caucus is going to be moving, somewhere in the middle. Not incremental. We have to move fast. It can't be a slow, but it's got to be something that motivates people to want to move in that way, and nothing motivates Americans like the right kind of market. So that's what we're trying to figure out, how to get there.
My last question before we open it up to the audience. In your 18 years in the Senate, I have admired your ability to cooperate with people of very different values, interests, perspectives. Here at Loyola, at the law school and other departments on campus, we think a lot about how to teach students the importance of cooperating with people from many different political stripes and ideological stripes and how to get things done. And so I'm always interested as an educator, what could universities like ours do that we don't do, perhaps, to teach the skills in respecting and cooperating with those who have different ideologies than we do, but who may have some shared interests?
Now, that's a really important question, and I think our country is struggling with that in so many different ways. I mean, I'll share with you one thing that I learned as younger, and it could be applied. I was invited to go on a trip when I was in my 20s by this nonprofit. I couldn't believe it. I got called and they said, could you make a trip to the Netherlands? I almost hung up on the lady. I said, ma'am, I don't have $300 in my savings account. How could I pay for a trip? She said, well, no, it's free. It's free for young political leaders that we want to. It was just kind of one of those amazing, wonderful things that happens in your life. So I go over outside of the country for the first time is the point. And I was sitting with a group of young German leaders when I was in my 20s, and they were saying things that made me really mad about the United States. Like, I'd never heard anyone criticize our country. I was not happy about this. You know, I can't even remember exactly what they were saying, but the point of it is, early on I thought, you know, Mary, you've just been talking to a lot of people that think just the same way you do. They see things the same way you do, but when you're in a room and you're listening to, you know, a young German leader that looks at the United States differently. So it really, that was like the first spark that I can remember. I would think a law school like this would want to have a law school exchange with Liberty University or some very conservative university and have some of the law students come over and have a discussion about, well, what would you do to solve the climate problem? You know, would you like the Green New Deal, or do you want this or that? Or how would you, what do you think about social justice or environmental justice? What is your view about it? I mean, when you go to the Congress and you run into people who have such different ideas and they come from such different places, and you're like, how could they possibly think that? But that's not only how they think, that's how everybody in their district thinks. And it's shocking in a way to get there because you realize, oh my goodness, you know, people in Washington State feel very differently than we do about certain things. So if you're a good legislator, you'll figure out how to listen to them and, like I said, try to find common ground. So Maria Cantwell and I she hates oil and gas drilling. I represent an oil and gas drilling state. But we could both kind of support the idea, well, you know, maybe if we don't expand it, she would say, maybe we could use the revenues to fix the coast. I could be for that, as long as you're not drilling off of Washington's coast. You see what I'm saying? Or if you're working on it. So it's just a matter of being open and realize that you're not the only, your idea isn't always the best and brightest, but also being willing to compromise. So when you go home, being willing to have people say, well, you left half the loaf on the table. Yes, I did. I mean, people have told me that. Why did you do Go Mesa? We only got $375 million. You know, we get a billion. I said, well, it was that or nothing. I mean, you know, I wanted more. We tried to get more. But you either took that and it's going to go a long way. We need more. So it's compromise. It's keeping an open mind. And it really is learning to listen to the other side. And no, we're going to have to do that better than we've ever done it on this climate issue, because I don't know how we're going to bring both of these sides together. And this presidential race is really going to be important. It's unfortunate that we have someone in the White House that doesn't add a thing to the discussion in any enlightening way currently. But we have people running for that office and other members of the House and the Senate, Republicans, that do bring some light to the subject. And if maybe Congress, the congressional leaders, can focus on it, we can make a difference. So thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, I think a lot of us think about the way that the conversation about what's politically possible is oftentimes a conversation driven by the stakeholders that have the most skin in the game, which a lot of times means the most money. And now that you've been on both sides of it, both as a politician and a lobbyist, I wonder if you could talk about the effects of money on the political process.
Well, clearly, you know, it does have an impact, but I'm not sure it's the big bad wolf that everybody thinks it is, in the sense that, you know, people that supported me financially, I would give attention to, but I also saw tons of people in my office that never gave me a penny, and I also listened to thousands of people that didn't support me and tried to listen to their views and just tried to make the best decisions I could. When I say political, it's not, political isn't bad. Political is reflecting the way the people of your district feel, or try to reflect the way they believe. But I wouldn't say it doesn't have an impact, but I'm not sure it's always the deciding factor. There have been examples of people who have won races, for instance, who spent half of what their opponents spent and they won. You know what I'm saying? However, but there is an abuse in the system right now, and that was after the, you know, the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, where it's not just contributions, they're undisclosed. You don't even know who's sending the money. So if it was disclosed, at least the public would know this $1 million came from X or this $2 million came from Y. That is a real problem, I think, if you're transparent. And then I've personally supported limits on contributions. So you're right in the sense, let's get money out, let's get less money in the system, reduce it, make it completely transparent. But I wouldn't say that's the entire problem.
And then, so how's your perspective changed on the sort of lobbying side of the equation and about having access?
Well, you know, that's interesting because I am a lobbyist. I do some lobbying. I represent CPRA. I represent our Coastal Zone Protection Authority, and I'm really proud to represent them and fight every day to secure our coast. That's one of my clients. I also represent an exporter of natural gas, and I believe in the use of natural gas, particularly if it can displace oil from Russia or resources from Russia and help democracies around the world depend more on the United States than Russia or Saudi Arabia. I'm all for that. But I also lobby for nonprofits, for orphans, for public schools, and don't get paid a penny. And I do it as an advocate. So lobbying, you can be paid for it and make a ton of money, or you can do it as a volunteer and lobby your legislators on issues that you feel are important. And so the action of petitioning your members of Congress, there's nothing wrong with that. We should be doing that all the time, advocating on behalf of things we believe in. And I get in to see a lot of legislators on behalf of orphans and kids, and I don't send them checks. You know, now they know me and I have a relationship. So, but, you know, it's good to petition your members. I wish we could get more money out of the system, and I wish it would be more transparent.
Could you explain the history of the determination of where federal land, federal rights start in the Gulf, and why there's such a disparity between Texas and Louisiana?
It has to do with the way the states came into the Union, and maybe there's a professor or expert shaking their head. It's simply this the way. In fact, did y'all know that Texas could succeed, I think? Can't they succeed, Texas, when they wrote themselves in? They could buy a boat.
It's debatable.
It's debatable.
I think
okay.
It's debatable.
All right, there's something somebody told me, like they could, under the way they came into the Union, they could vote themselves out. They might one of these days, but without a war, I guess. But that's how they came in. But as much as I would like to have 10 miles like Texas does, okay, we have 3, they have 10. Our drilling goes out 200 miles. So even if you fix that, you wouldn't fix what I'm talking about. Even if we moved our line out to 10 miles, we'd still pick up a few million dollars a year. But what we really want is to share in the federal resources offshore. If we got 30% of those resources, or 37, Wyoming gets 50%. I think the justice for the Gulf would be 50%, which would be about $5 billion a year. That's a lot of money. We could do a lot of coastal building along the Gulf of Mexico. That's just our states. Now, we could share that with the whole country. That's still a lot. It's still enough for everyone. And that's the bill that we're thinking about putting in right now, is a $5 billion something, or $3 or $4 or $5 billion bill for the coastal communities to share. Now you're starting to talk about significant resiliency, I mean, with guidelines about how that money is spent and put in the right buckets and right places to help. But even if we moved our line out 10, it wouldn't solve the problem. It's really getting a percentage of what's drilled, or directing some of the monies from, for coastal resiliency issues. But let me just say this on that point, because it's important. Republicans, who are very reluctant right now to support any kind of carbon tax, in fact, I think there are only 2 or 3 Republican members of the House that have indicated support. You can look it up. There are 200 plus, and there's not one member of the Senate Republicans, except maybe Susan Collins, that's indicated she would be open. So that's a long way to go from those numbers to where we need. But Republicans might be supportive of a carbon dividend, which is one of the bills in, that generates trillions of dollars, but it goes back in a dividend payment to all the taxpayers, because what they say is, you're raising extra money, but you're not expanding government. You're not expanding government programs. The money that you raise is going back to the people in direct payments. It would be like a check based on your income, like Alaska does. Alaska has a permanent fund where everybody in Alaska gets about $2,000 a year, once a year. It's gone up or down. They get that from their mineral resources. Republicans might be convinced, because it's not technically raising taxes, because you're raising it, but you're giving it right back. So they call it a tax dividend. But the reason that Sheldon Whitehouse doesn't like that is because Sheldon wants to use that money for all the things that you would want to use the money for, Rob. So see, if Rob was there, he wouldn't vote for the dividend. He would vote with Sheldon Whitehouse. I, on the other hand, might be convinced that if it's the only way we can do it, I might be convinced to vote for the dividend plan. Because I figure if it's don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And while I prefer that, politically you might not be able to get enough votes. And at the end of the day, It's about votes. It's about votes, and it's about whether Trump would veto something like that. So you can see the risk that the Republicans are in, not understanding what this president will do. It's very difficult to ask a member to vote, walk way out on a limb, and then have the president veto something. And he's very unpredictable, to say the least. And so we're in a very tough situation. Okay, thanks.
Senator Mary Landrieu, thank you so much.
Well, that's our show. You can visit our show page to get more information on Senator Landrieu and the topics we discussed. You can follow me on Twitter, at Rob Virchik. Thanks again to the Center for Environmental Law and the Loyola University New Orleans. Our music today was performed by Arto Fescapism, and our theme music, as always, is by Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.